The final speaker I interviewed was thoracic surgical oncologist Dr. David Jablons. We began with another topic related to local treatment of non-small cell, the newly published randomized trial of screening for lung cancer, and Dr. Jablons began by providing some perspective on this landmark data set.
It's been actually a very exciting year for lung cancer. The last few years have been really quite exciting with, you know, on the systemic side, targeted therapies, identification of genes that can drive cancer and drugs, pills, whatever that can target them. And we'll talk about that. But even while all of that excitement has been going on for the treatment, for the most part, of advanced stage patients, there has been a renaissance going on, you know, in the good old-fashioned dark ages here of early stage management. And to that end, you know, it's been a long-standing debate about what tool could we use if we had one, you know, would it be effective? And ultimately, the question is, how do you define effective, meaning is it, you know, delay in recurrence or is it actual survival benefit for a screening technology for lung cancer? And I mean, just to back up a step, you know, we've been doing these talks on and off for many years, and I really appreciate the chance to work with you, and also because I think you have great outreach to where the rubber meets the road in lung cancer. And the point is, you know, lung cancer overall survival hasn't really budged much, you know, 15.5%. The joy and the greatness of all the targeted therapies, the next drug, systemic therapy, pemetrexed, crizotinib, whatever, you know, this is great, but none of these drugs are curing people.
And, you know, just to put it in context too, you know, I've been just, God, it's just so freaky to read about world events and, you know, the wars that are going on. But there's more than 1 million people a year die of lung cancer in the world. 1 million people.
No, exactly right.
And it's actually a lot of people.
Yeah, it's more. It's 1.3 million and rising. And it's predicted, you know, we do a lot of work in China, and it's predicted that there will be 1 million deaths a year alone, Cai Chungguo, in China in the next 5 years.
Wow.
That's how crazy that perfect storm of an epidemic is, with rampant smoking, genetic susceptibility, and other co-carcinogen pollution issues. But anyway, back to the screening question. So point of story is survival hadn't budged a lot, 15.5% 5 year. Why is that? Well, you know, advanced stage patients were making small but real progress. But in the early stage, we still, unfortunately, absent of a good screening technology, which we now have in this tool of CT CAT scan screening, absent of that, we saw 10 to 20, 30% only stage one or stage two patients picked up in the United States. So that's a little bit of a dilemma, and it's not a huge surprise that the majority of patients, 60, 70%, present with either locally metastatic disease in their mediastinum or full-on 40% distant metastatic disease, and they present from a symptom from their brain med or bone pain, et cetera. So, you know, we're not going to win there. Where we're going to win is when we can identify early stage patients. And then you would say, well, I mean, come on, this is crazy. We know that the predominant risk factor, but not the only, but the predominant risk factor for the development of lung cancer is smoking and tobacco. Now, more and more, you know, 20% of this 220,000 in this country, whatever, are in never smokers, and almost a third of the diagnoses in women right now, quite amazingly, are in never smokers. And in Asia, it's 50% are in never smokers. But the point is, you know, we have a risk factor we can identify, and so we should be able to screen these patients. So historically, screening was looked at in the 60s, 70s with the Mayo Clinic and others with a chest x-ray, which was the tool du jour that we had, and it was woefully inadequate. It's kind of better than a stethoscope, but it wasn't going to give us any real information. Well, CAT scans came along, and they have been perfected, and high-energy, quick electron CTs can now be given with very low-dose radiation, non-contrast, because it's not really an issue of finding a mass around the central pulmonary vessels, whatever. So limited risk, no contrast, low-dose CT. It's a very effective tool for finding nodules in the lung. And all of us, you know, after 30, 40 years of age, pretty much have a nodule, a non-calcified 2 to 3 to 6 millimeter nodule in our lung. The vast majority of these nodules are not, emphasis, not cancer. Okay. So how do you use this high-powered tool that we have? It's very, very sensitive, not absolutely specific, such as a CT scan. Well, how would you enrich for that? And the way you enrich for that is you take a population that's at highest risk. So cancer is a disease of aging for the most part. So you take people over 50, 55, and then you identify whether they've had a smoking history. And so the criteria for entering into the ACRIN study, the American College Radiation Radiology study for screening that has now been published, was patients over 50-55 and a 20 to 25 pack year history of smoking. So they're at risk, okay? And then it accrued 50,000 patients. It's quite outrageous. These are all prior smokers, right?
And randomized.
And it randomized half of them. 25,000 got...
Amazing.
A quote, sort of standard of care, which is a joke because really there is no standard of care, right? American Cancer Society, no current, up until recently, recommendation for screening. Anyway, 25,000 got a chest x-ray and 25,000 got a CT screen, a la the LCAP study. And Claudia Henschke, to her credit, you know, there have been some bumps along the road for her there, but ultimately let the record reflect that she was right and she was a pioneer and followed these patients. And what happened is if you found a nodule that was suspect, you repeated the CT scan, and, you know, cancers, with the exception of a low-grade adenocarcinoma in situ, the old bronchoalveolar smudge lesion, with the exception of those, a real lung cancer will grow in time. And so over 3 months and follow-up and 6 months, if it was unclear, and with the right three-dimensional imaging reconstruction, you could see growth. If you saw growth, you needled it. If it was cancer, you took it out. And the good news is they're small lesions for the most part. 90% were less than 2 centimeters, and they proved to be stage one tumors. Not all, though. 10% were 3A already, even with a small tumor. So go figure, and no enlarged lymph nodes. But that's all the details. Well, what happened is early analysis showed a dramatic 20% survival, not just delay in recurrence, not just morbidity, but a survival benefit in the patients who were screened with this low-dose non-contrast CT. And so that has been the definitive study now, published in, of course, the August New England Journal of Medicine this past year. And it really is sort of irrefutable data. The data speak for themselves. The largest, baddest study ever done, 50,000 Americans randomized, accrued in 9 months. You know, that's the magnitude of this problem. 75 million, 50 million reformed smokers, 75 million smokers in this country. That if you're over 50, you smoked for 20 pack years, a pack a day for 20 years, half a pack for 40 years, whatever, you should ask and have this discussion with your primary care doc, your internist, cardiologist, pulmonologist, whomever, next door neighbor if he's a doctor or she, and say, listen, do I need a screen CAT scan? And the answer is, you know, you'd be eligible, it would be paid for, and you might find a small nodule, a cancer, early stage cancer, that will save your life. And if you look at survival, just finally to comment on this, you know, in Japan, they've been doing screening for a decade. And the average thoracic surgeon there goes to work and comes home a happy man, you know, smoking there and back, but nonetheless a happy person. And the reason is that 50% of their patients, Neil, are stage 1A. So they're curing these patients. And we're doing it with VATs and little incisions, drive-through procedures. You know, it's as good as it gets, right? In this country, it's not that good. Well, they embraced CT screening a decade ago. And so it goes to show. And now we know that we can help these patients. So we're very excited in the lung cancer community. There are still a few naysayers out there, but I think even they had to acknowledge the fact that this trial, you know, and Denny Aberle was the PI out of UCLA. She did an amazing job. It was a brilliantly conducted multi-center trial and has a lot of correlative data. There's serum collected, there's tissue. You know, there's a lot that we'll learn from this over the next few years. But for the most part right now, the primary message was it was a positive trial in favor of screening. And honestly, this is the first time in my recollection that a prospective randomized trial showing the benefit of screening for cancer was really done. You know, breast cancer screening never had a prospective randomized trial for mammography, and yet it got embraced. It's getting challenged now, honestly, ironically or not. But for lung cancer, we know that under those criteria, patients should undergo screening.
I think maybe there was a randomized study, but of course it was 100 years ago, but in breast cancer.
Yeah.
In terms of this thing, though, in terms of the data, et cetera, there is one aspect to the data that you haven't commented on, which is the downside. And you would think, I guess, the major issue is unnecessary biopsies. What do we know quantitatively about that?
Right. So people always are a little suspect, rightly so. And based on a decade of LCAP, the pre-randomized protocol screening that was done around the country, et cetera. You know, the incidence of sort of unnecessary biopsies was very small, 1% to 2%. And why I say that is because, remember, these patients did not get a biopsy necessarily right off the bat unless the lesion was, I forget the cutoff, you know, 1.5 centimeters, and then ultimately got a PET scan or just got the biopsy. But they monitored growth. Now, there can be non-malignant reasons why things grow, but for the most part, low-grade lesions like hamartomas, you know, granulomas, these things are not going to change significantly over time. A cancer, you know, especially with the sort of novel software technology that accompanied the screening equipment, you know, to interpret and integrate the data such that you could almost reconstruct the nodule in a three-dimensional impression, and you could see subtle growth that you might miss on a straight two-dimensional cross-sectional image. And so in those settings, you know, patients, their nodules demonstrated growth, they had a biopsy. And if the biopsy was positive, they went to resection. If it was negative and it was still growing, they went to a procedure. And for the most part, these are small lesions, mostly not all peripheral, and they could be encompassed with a video-assisted thoracoscopic wedge resection or small thoracotomy. And patients, the complication rate was exceedingly small. In fact, I think that was under 1%.
So I try to hide my, I'm kind of a closet anti-screener, and I get a little nervous about how this actually will play out in the community. And are people really going to use the algorithms in the trial, or, you know, they're going to start biopsying everything they see?
Well, who knows? But I would hope that they would use the algorithms in the trial because they were very carefully constructed. And again, to the credit of the PIs and all the investigators, co-investigators in the trial, they were very strict about following guidelines. Now, ultimately, you know, they won't get reimbursed, typically, if they're not along strict guideline indications.
Interesting. So kind of staying within the topic of sort of the new lung cancer, and in some ways, you know, in screening now, it's kind of following screening that's been looked at in other tumors, breast and prostate in particular. But the other thing you mentioned is genomic markers. And I have to admit, you know, when you came to the winter lung meeting to speak and sent your slides, when I looked at them, I was kind of shocked because you had sent me slides based upon a paper that was at that time just about to be published, and I certainly hadn't heard about it. And I've got to say, it's awfully interesting. I think oncologists in practice are going to find it interesting. What did you all do?
Well, Neil, thank you so much for that. And, you know, it is absolutely true. When we were in Florida there at the meeting, and that was a great meeting, I thought, the paper had been published online by The Lancet, but the actual print publication only came out a few weeks ago. And let me first disclose that, of course, this was technology that came out of a preliminary technology that came out of our laboratory at UCSF and then got outlicensed to a small diagnostics company that perfected it for an algorithm and for the gene ratio. But the concept was, and that has been being developed, you know, in multiple centers around the country and around the world, which was to try to find a molecular biomarker or collection of genes that could give a signature so that we could identify high-risk early stage patients. And again, you know, let's step back and say, what was the reason? You know, what was the indication? Well, okay, we're talking about finding early cancers. In the absence of screened cancers, you know, and even potentially with 1 centimeter screened cancers, we don't know exactly. The overall survival for stage one patients resected in the United States is 60%, 65%. In Japan, they do a little bit better staging, they get more screening. It might be a little bit higher, 75%. Et cetera, 80%. But for where the rubber meets the road here, good old USA, born in the USA, it's 60, 65%, which means, and these are patients who've had, you know, PET CTs beforehand, they have full-on lobectomy, they get somewhat adequate nodal sampling, hopefully, maybe hopefully a mediastinal node sampled, whatever. T1, N0, M0 with a brain MR or not, usually not for early stage disease, their survival is 60, 65%, which means 35 to almost 50% of these patients are failing, especially as this size goes up, of what? Occult micrometastatic disease. So, you know, the old-fashioned days of Anton van Leeuwenhoek, 16th century histology, you know, which has done good by us for 400 years in the era of the iPhone, et cetera, and the molecular revolution, personalized medicine, time for that to be modified and adopted to current biologic technology standards. So the point is, it's the biology of the tumor that can inform us as to whether that 1 or 2.5 centimeter lesion or even 4.5 centimeter lesion that's node negative, does that really mean it's localized disease only, or because of the intrinsic biology of the tumor, does the patient have occult micrometastatic disease that, of course, we cannot image. And the point is, up until recently, we've never had the data to know that we could identify these high-risk patients. So that was the exact purpose of our study. We had devised a multi-gene test. The current test that was developed by the company is a 14-gene test. It's actually 11 cancer-related genes.
I guess one of the things about lung cancer is that the fraction of patients who actually are in sort of the adjuvant situation is low, but the number of bodies of people is not low.
Exactly. I mean, it's a big number of patients, 50,000 patients in the United States.
That's a lot of people.
Stage one and two who would be eligible to benefit from this analysis. And then just to cut to the chase, so what we did, we had initially developed this assay on about 100 early on in a four-gene assay out of our laboratory and confirmed it just on snap-frozen samples, tissue from the OR. We knew that that would never be ready for prime time. In other words, it had to be deliverable out of paraffin, which does raise some technology barriers and issues that we had to overcome and the company overcame to perfect the technology. And now they were able to actually get a robust genetic signal of these 14 genes in 97% of all paraffin-extracted RNA from samples that were as old as 5 to 10 years ago that was done for the original discovery and validation. Now, what matters most in these tests is you can take a small subset of patients, 100, a couple hundred, and absent of blinded, independent, and large-scale validation, unfortunately, those tests are thought-provoking but are not going to ever change the world. So we set out to do the impossible to a certain extent, and we're lucky to succeed, honestly, and collaborated with our investigators and a research arm of the Kaiser Permanente healthcare system in Northern California. Stephen Vandenene was a PI who actually, they've done a lot of work, like you mentioned, in screening and genetic testing for prostate cancer and others. But, you know, in the Kaiser system, they have access to a lot of patients. They have the tissues. Because we could use paraffin samples at this point, it wasn't some rarefied, you know, ivory tower academic snap frozen surgery group. And the assay was developed by the company, this 14-gene assay with an algorithm. It was trained on about 500 samples, early stage patients out of the UCSF cohort. And then the assay was locked down, end of story, done.
So actually, I was just flashing on the first interview I did with Soon Paik about Oncotype the night before he presented it for the first time in San Antonio. I can't remember, it was at least 8 years ago. And then
Yes. We
watched that get debated for a long time and it kind of settled out. Then they came out with sort of an Oncotype colon, and that's still under raging debate.
Right.
And one of the things that came out with the colon was that oncologists were kind of disappointed because you didn't see a well, first of all, both of them looked at impact of treatment of adjuvant therapy, but the breast showed a differential relative benefit in the higher risk. The colon showed the same relative benefit, but still maybe useful. But you guys don't have any treatment data right now, so it's really purely prognostic.
That's exactly right. So the test right now is prognostic, but we are about to embark on a large-scale international prospective randomized trial that will validate the prognostic value, but also show, as you're alluding to, the predictive value that at the end of the day, in high-risk patients, a benefit from chemotherapy can be observed. And, you know, there's good evidence to suggest that in a high-risk identified patient by, you know, any molecular test, gene test, et cetera, that not only are those patients not resistant to chemotherapy, but actually their benefit can be significant and even better than unselected patients, meaning that it's not that they're going to be, their genome is so revved up that cytotoxic chemotherapy wouldn't work. It's just that these patients can benefit because they have the problem, occult disease, and the best time, of course, for any systemic cytotoxic to have a real impact is when you have a very, very low tumor burden. We're going to enroll 1,500 non-squamous patients, completely resected, you know, that had adequate surgical staging and clinical staging. Then we'll run the test. We'll then take about half of those patients, 700 or so, that will come back in the high-risk category, correct, by the molecular test, and then they'll be randomized to systemic chemotherapy with a platinum doublet, either platinum doublet du jour or possibly pemetrexed cisplatinum because it's an active agent in this patient population. And then we're going to follow them for time to progression and ultimately survival. we'll have molecular correlates and other stuff because we'll have access to the tissue, et cetera, which will be good. We are literally in the process of firing up this trial. It's going to get conducted on a global scale. We're going to do it, of course, with our China Clinical Trial Consortium. We're also going to do it on the West Coast through collaborating centers, academic and Kaiser and other. And we're going to do it in a few other centers, hopefully East Coast, the United States, as well as in Europe. And what this study showed, remember, is that in America, i.e. UCSF, Kaiser, stage one patients, 74% versus 45% survival. In China, you know, 8,000 miles across the large pond next to us here in California, in China, same issue, non-small cell, non-squamous lung cancer, curve separation, 75% versus 44%. So, you know, 14 genes, two continents, same answer. And I think that speaks to that point, and this is one of the remarkable findings of this study, is that lung cancer is lung cancer. Granted, we have a fair amount of Asian patients in the Bay Area for sure, but we can use China if done right, and we can collaborate on a global scale for all kinds of things that can accelerate discovery and validation and lead to the future today.